Hello, I'm Kevin Keith. In this episode of Skeptical Ethics, we'll discuss a question at the center of a heated controversy among gender rights activists, but which may be unfamiliar or even puzzling to those not steeped in the language and concepts of that issue. Is the standard perception that there are two biological sexes a scientific fact? Is biological sex a reliable foundation for sex-related concepts such as gender or sexual identity? What moral or social implications do the answers have? Before we start, let me remind listeners that the Skeptical Ethics series attempts to apply skeptical reasoning to value-based issues such as moral or cultural controversies. New listeners, or those who want to review the basic conceptual grounding of that enterprise, may wish to download the first Skeptical Ethics segment, Does Skepticism Lead to Agreement?, which appeared in Episode 2 of the Skeptical Connections podcast, and the second segment, Moral Agreement Among Skeptics, from Episode 3 of Skeptical Connections, for useful background. A great deal of social structure and human psychology centers around the notion of biological sex, that is, the categorization of human beings as determined by their reproductive functions. Genetic reproduction, in humans and most other sexually reproductive species, combines genes from two parents. Those parents have distinctive reproductive organs, and only parents with the complementary anatomy can mate to produce offspring. These anatomical forms are identified as male and female. In most cases, anatomical sex results from having a specific set of sex-determining chromosomes, and so genetic sex and biological sex are taken as the same thing, and each comes in just two flavors. Sex is a binary condition. You're either one thing or the other, under this view. However, things get more complicated because of two factors that are of special significance in the case of human beings. The first complication is that the basic biological facts just described are not true for all individuals of a given species. Some people do not inherit exactly two sex chromosomes, and so do not exhibit either the XX chromosome set typically found in females or the XY set typically found in males. In other cases, an individual may have the binary chromosome pair typical for one biological sex, but have genitalia similar to those typical of the other sex, or of both sexes. There are rarer cases of individuals who have functional gonads, the tissues producing sperm or eggs, that are typical of one sex, and external genitalia typical of the other, or even have gonadal tissue of both sexes. In short, the expectation that genetic, gonadal, and anatomical sex will all correspond to the typical sex binary makeup, that is, that everyone will have either XX sex chromosomes, egg-producing ovaries, and sex organs consisting of a uterus, vagina, and external labia, or they will have XY chromosomes, sperm-producing testes, and sex organs consisting of a penis, scrotum, and testicles, but no other combinations of these characteristics, is also false. Non-typical combinations, which collectively are referred to as intersex, are relatively rare, perhaps 1% of the population at most, and less than that for the most obvious or extreme cases, but they exist, and thus challenge the notion of binary sex as a firm biological fact. The second complicating factor, unique to humans, is the relationship between biology and culture in regard to sex. In many societies, there are rigid traditional stereotypes surrounding the concept of binary sex, but which are not biologically based. These include stereotypes of psychology and personality, such as that women have a distinct psychological profile and ways of behaving, and men have another. They also include culturally defined expectations for social roles and activities, such as whether men or women are qualified for certain jobs, or what roles they'll play in child rearing. These social stereotypes are termed gender, as distinct from the biological concept of sex, but again with a traditional expectation of a clear link between the two, such that there are just two genders and that each biological sex is linked to one behavioral gender and not the other. If your chromosomes and genitals are male, you are expected to act like a man, and similarly for women. But here again, we know that this simplistic dichotomy is false. Stereotype gender expectations have been shown to be no more than cultural conditioning in the vast range of cases, so that today the remaining debate is not whether most gender roles are equally compatible with both male and female biological sex, but whether there are any that are not. The belief that either sex or gender are determinist, fixed, and binary is called essentialism, the idea that sex and gender are somehow part of the basic essence of human beings, unavoidable and unchangeable. The factual falsehood of the binary hypothesis regarding both sex and gender renders the traditional view of sexual or gender essentialism false also. It's obvious how that theme is relevant to the quest for political and social equality for women. The death of binary gender essentialism cut the ground from under scientific sexism, the attempt to impose rigidly traditional gender roles by arguing that they were essentialist. And I think most skeptics will agree that the still ongoing retreat from such beliefs has been a good thing, morally and socially. But assuming, first, that binary biological sex and gender essentialism are false, and second, that social constraints based on false notions of sex and gender are unjustifiable, is there more to be said? One logical implication of the idea that gender essentialism is false is that gender itself may be a false concept. If there is nothing about biological facts such as genetics or sexual morphology that makes life roles essentially gendered, then what is there that makes any part of life distinctly male or female? This is expressed by feminists in the concept of gender as performance, something we do and are often taught or pressured to do, rather than something that we inherently are. Correspondingly, even roles based on the more objective foundation of biological sex may be less essentialist than they seem. The advent of sex reassignment procedures has made the correspondence of genetic sex and anatomical sex, already ambiguous in the case of intersex individuals, actually optional for those who choose to alter the appearance they had developed biologically. Also, as many people do not realize, transsexual procedures involve many different treatments in independent steps, and in recent years, individuals in transition have been making their own choices about exactly which of those treatments they want. Not everyone chooses a complete transition to full adoption of the opposite binary sex appearance, and so there's a growing community of persons with different and non-binary combinations of primary and secondary bodily sexual characteristics, independent of what their genetics or morphology at birth may have been. There are also cases of individuals who have transitioned from female to male sex characteristics and adopted male gender, but retained their female reproductive organs and carried full-term pregnancies to birth, while presenting themselves socially as male. Some such individuals have been described in the press as, quote, a pregnant man, end quote, but it might be more accurate to say that sex chromosomes, sex organs, sexual appearance, and gender identity are simply not as closely linked in fact as they are assumed to be by tradition. The idea that those categorizations are both non-binary and not rigidly linked has become a political watchword for sex and gender activists who find that traditional assumptions about sex and gender do not include categories for who they feel themselves to be. These issues overlap with political activism over sexual identity, also traditionally linked to binary, biological, and social categories, which are rejected by those who do not fit such definitions. Social patterns and laws, however, have resisted adopting the non-essentialist view of things. For instance, there have been heated legal fights across the U.S. over who's allowed to use what bathrooms in public places, or whether married persons who transition their sexual morphology can remain married in states that don't allow gay marriage. Thus, changes to scientific views on the validity of biological categorizations by sex also bolster revisionist theories of the links between sex, gender, and social identities and roles. Rejecting those changes strengthens the traditional binary view. This issue is ripe for scientific skeptical analysis, but doing so may require taking on weighty conceptual issues. One is the entire concept of category definition. Is binary categorization wrong if 99% or more of the population can be unambiguously categorized into just two groups? In taxonomy, there's a famous conflict between lumpers, who tend to group many specimens into just a few species, and splitters, who tend to put each in its own unique taxon. It is in part a disagreement over perspective. In taxonomizing biological sex, however, issues of perspective can have moral implications. For instance, what do we teach children in biology classes? The standard biology lesson regarding reproductive functions held that there were two sexes. If sex is in fact non-binary, that lesson isn't correct. But many people object to having non-traditional ideas, particularly those associated with sexual minority groups, taught to children. Is this an example of bigotry, or is there a question of teaching ethics involved? For decades, it was standard practice to perform surgery on intersex infants to make their genital anatomy conform to the binary standard, and then to impose gendered cultural conditioning to influence the children to grow into the stereotype gender role that corresponded to the assigned sex. But experience proved that such efforts were often unsuccessful or even harmful, and the practice is seen as a form of assault by those who assert intersex as its own unique and valid biological sex category. Do such surgeries repair a clear pathology? Or do they erase the truth of ambiguity? In these and other ways, the question of what we accept as the facts of the case partly determines what justifications we accept for reinforcing or overthrowing traditional social patterns incorporating those concepts. Arguing for a radical revision of our received norms of biological identity and cultural roles is easier if the apparent scientific basis of such norms is weakened. But questions of solid facts of biology may hinge on our opinion on much more abstract questions of perception, whether we focus on the majority or the exceptions, whether we are lumpers or splitters on the notion of human sexual identity. In this segment of Skeptical Ethics, we haven't come to a clear conclusion on the question of categorization, but we have recognized the surprisingly ambiguous nature of apparently simple questions of scientific fact, and we have recognized that the position we take as scientific thinkers on these somewhat abstract questions may have consequences for issues of great moral and social controversy. Thanks for listening. I invite your comments and questions on this issue. Please feel free to contact me through skepticalconnections.com, and I hope you'll join me next week for more of the same.